My guest today is Glasgow-born photographer Mark Mann, who has built this stunning career photographing some of the most iconic celebrities in the world. From Robert Redford, Michael Douglas, Iggy Pop, the Black Eyed Peas, to Seinfeld, Rihanna, Queen Latifah, Stevie Wonder, Bradley Cooper, Willie Nelson, and hundreds of others. The funny thing is, Mark pretty much stumbled into photography in the most unexpected way in his late teens, which is a story that he shares, and then ended up on a plane to New York City, where with little experience, he found himself dropped into the world of hip-hop and music, focusing his lens on some of the early icons in the space. He fell in love with the stories the people's faces told and started spending more and more time developing this really powerful signature approach to hyper-vivid, close-up, black-and-white portraits that in some way it kind of captures a moment, a mood, a vibe, a story. And behind the scenes, it's been anything but a straight line or an easy path for Mark. As is common in the world of photography, there's what the public sees, and then there is the reality of the photographic life, which is not often an easy one. But for him, it has been the source of profound connection and a life of stories that will live in his mind long after the images themselves fade. So excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. Good Life Project is brought to you by Understood Explains, a podcast that's like a beacon for parents navigating the special education system. Hosted by Juliana Urtube, a special education expert, this season is all about individualized education plans, or IEPs. Juliana breaks down complex topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP in a way that's easy to grasp. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains about the difference between IEPs and 504 plans, and I was struck by the balance of empathy and practical advice. It's not just about understanding the system. It's about empowering parents and caregivers to advocate for their children, which is just so important. So I've known a number of people who've had to literally scramble to figure out how to advocate for their kids when the system seemed to just make it so hard to get the support that they need and deserve. So if you're a parent navigating this world, or even just wondering if it's right for your family, I encourage you to give Understood Explains a listen. Search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. It's like having a roadmap for a journey you didn't expect, making it a little less daunting.
Glasgow was a great place to grow up. It really was. I'm Jewish, and the Jewish community was a little bit bigger than it is now. It's dwindling, but it was great culturally. And I mean, I didn't really experience any anti-Semitism of any notable note. You see, more in Glasgow, it was like the Catholics and the Protestants were so busy fighting that once again, if you were Jewish, it's like, oh, we don't care. So, I mean, I thought it was a great place to grow up.
Yeah. It sounds like it's funny when we ask all of our guests is just, you know, like fill out a quick form before we hang out just to get a little bit of background. And the bottom question is always, it's something like, you know, like, is there anything else we should know? And your answer was, I may be in the bathtub when we're speaking. So there's clearly a sense of a reverence that sounds like it's also probably been there from the early days.
Yeah, it's funny. It's Glasgow banter, man. You can't, there's nowhere else like it. You can't get away with anything. You know, when I go home, my friends who I've known my whole life will say, so you think you're fancy now living in New York? You think you're all fancy, do you? You're not. And it's just this immediate bring back to earth. And it's incredibly grounding, but it's amusing. You know, it's funny. You can't, it's the banter. The banter is phenomenal. I miss that.
Yeah, it's like forced humility at high speed.
You've obviously been there. Yeah, I mean,
it's funny. I have a very good friend who's his name is Scotty, but it's actually not his real name. He's from Scotland also, and as soon as he dropped down into sort of, you know, like the London area, which is where he's been, just immediately people started calling him Scotty just because of his accent, and that for his entire adult life now that's his name.
I hated London. I never wanted to live in London. It was, oh God, London. I mean, of all the major cities, and I've been super fortunate to have been in a few, London just, only much, much later in life, and I was, you know, sent to London as a photographer to do a job, and, you know, we could take a taxi from Heathrow and not the subway, the underground, and, you know, straight into central London and into a nice, you know, fancy hotel. And, oh, London's quite nice. But my experience from London before was all my friends that moved there had these damp flats in North London. It was so depressing. It was horrible. And then to get anywhere took forever. I much prefer Glasgow to London.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. Not dissing London, but it's a different place.
I could
place.
Go on for a while about London.
So it sounds like for you, art kind of touched down fairly early in your life. It didn't show up as photography in the beginning, mm-hmm. but it sounds like in the earliest days, there was an artistic impulse in you.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed it. I definitely enjoyed it. And I think I started off by kind of copying cartoons, you know, trying to draw little characters from cartoons. Photography, I had no idea. I mean, photography was just something like your dad did on holiday. You know, it was nothing. And then I really wanted to do art. And it was two things that kind of happened simultaneously. I had made these sculptures in clay, which I really liked. And I really enjoyed them and they were great. And then similar kind of time, some of my buddies were in Edinburgh at the Edinburgh Festival, and I went on the train from Glasgow to Edinburgh. I must have been about 15 or 14, 15, maybe 16. A bit of a chancer, but, you know, bit of a fool of myself, and get on the train, and there's one four seat with this very beautiful young lady, older lady, must have been at least 17 or 18, maybe even 19. Just intriguing looking, I suppose, now in retrospect, bohemian might be the term. But I wasn't really too accustomed to this look. And I'm sitting down. So I sat down, we started talking, and she told me she was studying photography at Manchester School of Art. I was like, oh, that's what I'm going to do. I'll see you there. And, you know, she kind of explained to me about what art school was and what, you know, I'd never heard this from anyone. And I came back from the festival and I had a very good relationship with my dear art teachers, one especially, Mr. Marshall. And I said to him, do we have any photography in school? He goes, yeah, we got a dark room. I said, oh, great, what's that? And he said, well, why don't we photograph some of your sculptures and then we can make prints of them in the darkroom? So I said, that's a great idea. Do you have a camera? So he had a camera and we took some photos, and then he's so enthusiastic. I mean, he took me into the darkroom before we kind of processed that film. And, you know, as soon as you kind of, for me, as soon as I walked in and the smell, the chemicals and the red light, it was just a very cool place. And I don't think I'd ever been in anywhere as cool as this. And we didn't have any negatives. So he got a sheet of photo paper, and I think I took off my glasses, and he had some keys or something. We put it on a sheet of photo paper, very Man Ray style. We shone the light down, and then he put it in the developer. And I just, it was alchemy. I mean, it was just something shifted inside me. And that's all I ever wanted to do from that moment on. My dad, a little camera, started taking pictures with that. Applied to Manchester Polytechnic, to the School of Art, got in. The young lady was in, I think, her third year when I got into my foundation course. There was no romantic interlude, but we did remain friends and speak occasionally till this day. That's the start.
That's amazing. Do you ever wonder? I'm fascinated with the concept of sliding doors.
You know, yeah, man.
If you hadn't just randomly first met this woman on the train, and then if you hadn't gone back to school, and your teacher's like, oh yeah, we happen to have a dark room and taken an interest, you know, like those two just moments that set in motion an entire lifetime of work. Like, did you ever wonder if those didn't happen?
All the time. I still like, maybe I'd be able to afford lunch if that had happened. You know, where I was like, wow, could I use my brain to do something that actually made money? No, I do wonder. I mean, if I go back to, I mean, art was my thing at high school. So one of the purposes of making the photographs of the clay sculptures was because if you're going to apply to art school, maybe then, you know. So I think I would have always, I don't know. I really, really don't know. And to this day, I don't even know, you know, as you talk about sliding doors, would I have been better at something else? I mean, it's not hard to be better at photography, but I don't know, man. It's such an interesting question. It's really interesting.
I'm fascinated by those. I mean, some people, there's sort of like this slow, gradual progression and a build over time. And then some people, there's like a moment or an experience or a person that just drops down and everything changes. And for you, it sounds like there is this maker impulse in you that was yearning to get, and it would have probably found its way out some way. But
I think so.
The way that it has with you, it's pretty amazing.
I kind of wanted to be an architect for about 5 minutes.
so did I, actually. Between being pre-med and this, I was like, I'm going to go to architecture school. When you get out of Manchester, it sounds like you went almost immediately to New York.
Yeah, there was a very painful period in between where a lot of my buddies in school were actually from London or Manchester. And, you know, my buddies from London went back to London. And then a lot of my non-photo buddies got jobs, right? So they moved to London with jobs. How am I moving to London, man? I don't have, like, any money. I got nothing. I've got a portfolio of weird art crap that I've created over the last 4 years. I have absolutely no idea how to get a job as a photographer. I mean, I have no idea what I want to do. I mean, it was just like, all right, thanks for the education. So I moved back to Glasgow, which was kind of, I mean, that's really what I had to do. And I also didn't like London, but I mentioned that. So I moved back to Glasgow and I start shipping around my portfolio, like calling design firms and ad firms, and start to pick up a few jobs, furniture catalogs, etc. And I'd been there about 2 years, maybe, after, I don't know, I'd have to check. And I'm getting pretty, I've got like a couple of recurring catalog, furniture catalogs that I do a month that I mean, for me, it was very well paid, but enough to afford a rent and all this. And I'm thinking, maybe I should buy an apartment, stop paying rent. And then I couldn't explain what it was, but I knew there was something that was stopping me doing that. I'm not sure what. And then another tremendous piece of luck is that the woman I was with, who was an absolute love of my life, decided she didn't want to be with me anymore. And I just had to, she was in London actually, so I was up and down a lot, but I just felt I had to leave the country. I couldn't get far enough away. So I had a buddy that was in New York selling diamonds, and I called him and said, hey, can I come for a minute? And he goes, yeah, come as long as you want. So I planned like this 2 week, 3 week. The first time I went home was 2 years later or 3 years later to get my visa. And that was it. And New York was just mind-blowing. I got to New York, and I think one of the first or second nights I went to party with somebody who I knew from somewhere. And all of a sudden, I'm talking to this really cool girl called Forrest, who was Annie Leibovitz's studio manager. I'm like, oh, talking to Annie. So, you know, things happen super fast in New York, but then super slow. So all of a sudden, my portfolio seemed more relevant to the kind of going to see magazines and stuff. And I started to pick up a few bits and pieces here and there. I got an agent, which was bizarre, but I think somebody saw potential. And I got this job in LA for Entertainment Weekly. And I went out to LA and I had my portfolio, my camera bag, and like two pairs of underwear and a pair of socks, which is pretty much everything I owned, plus my passport. Because, I came on vacation, you know, and I did the job and it was great. And we FedExed the film from the studio back to New York to my lab. And then I knew somebody who knew somebody, and they said, well, I have lunch with this guy. So I drove to his house in a rental car, came out of lunch. The trunk of the rental car had been broken into, camera gone, clothes gone.
Oh, man.
Portfolio gone.
Oh, no. And this was the day where, like, it was probably all film, right? So there wasn't a digital backup, right? Yeah. Oh, man.
And all my negatives are in Scotland, right? Ah. Because, you know, I hadn't, you know, most of the work that was in my book was, you know, and my negs are in Scotland. So I get home and I get back to my agent. She goes, like, can you get a new book? And I'm like, ah. She goes, call us when you get a new book. I'm like, okay. So then, thankfully, there's the silver linings and all these things. I started to assist, and I assisted for 2 or 3 years, still trying to shoot, or 4 years. And I really learned, I think, more than anybody could have ever taught me about the business and how it works. And, you know, I came up that way a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, in New York also, especially that time. So we're talking sort of like late 90s-ish, right? Early 2000s.
No. I came in 87. It's probably 91.
Okay. So late 80s, early 90s. Which was, I mean, it's a little bit of, you know, it's weird to say there's a golden era of photography in New York, but I feel like there was a season in New York. A
lot going on.
Where it was just some incredible work. I mean, you mentioned Leibovitz, but there were also, I mean, there were so many people who were doing, really pushing the envelope of what the expectation of photography and what you could do around that window. You ended up assisting for at least a chunk of time, I guess, with Miles Aldridge.
Yeah, I worked for Miles for a while. I'm a great admirer and respecter of his work. I think he's very talented, but it was more an excellent example for me of how not to treat people. You know, it was what it was, and I learned a ton. I'll always be thankful to that. But it was like, wow, I can't believe you're saying that or you're doing that. And I think working for a few people like that made me very different in how I was when I was the boss and I had assistants, probably to my detriment, actually. I mean, you know, if I did a dollar for every one time my wife said, you're too nice, you should be harder on these things, push back. I don't have the energy, man. I just want it to go smooth. And it's nobody's fault but mine, right? I mean, it's the bottom line with the photographer, it's nobody's fault but mine.
Yeah, but At the end of the day, though, I mean, what do you have? You have your work, and you have the relationships that you build with people, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And they both matter, you know, they both, it's
a lot.
It's not just the money you get paid for what you're doing that, you know, like adds up to a good life.
Are we supposed to get paid?
the classic photography lie, right?
Do we get paid for this? You're right. And, you know, I have great relationships with so many of the people that I came up with. So many of the photographers that came up with me are not taking photos anymore, sadly. But a lot of the stylists are, a lot of the makeup artists, and we're all kind of like, oh shit, we're all old school now.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. So around that, we've had Danny Clinch on the podcast before.
Legend.
Because he was assisting for Annie Leibovitz. I think it was right around that similar time. And it's interesting to see who's, like you said, who's still around, who's still shooting, what they're shooting, and whether they really substantially change what they're doing. I mean, it sounds like for you, you kind of emerge from this season of, you know, like really developing the craft and learning the business, and you land doing a whole lot of work for Source magazine.
Yeah, yeah. That was crazy, though. That was
how does that happen? Because it's not the most logical sort of like, okay, next step for you.
Well, there's a fellow called David Cucurito who went on to I know he has his own design firm now, but he was the creative director for a tiny little publication called Manhattan File, and I can't remember. Oh, yeah, I went in cold called with my book, you know, as a magazine. It was very much a society magazine. I don't know if you remember it or whatever, but he kind of dug my portraits and he gave me a couple of commissions. One was Bret Easton Ellis, and one was Jay McInerney. And I think mostly because I had no idea what I was doing, I produced some interesting portraits. Oh, camera, light, okay. And I did that, and then he wanted to give me a cover, and he gave me a cover of Candace Bushnell. So right in the, maybe the first kind of season of Sex and the City, and it was huge. I managed to get this shot of her lying on a bed, and I had no desire for her to get undressed. But she said, can we do it naked if I'm like that? I'm like, okay. It was just it's not my way. The more clothes you've got on, the better for me. I'm really uncomfortable. But we did this shot and it was a very, very successful cover for them. It was beautifully retouched and it was a successful cover. And then all of a sudden, sort of some other things started to happen around that. But Cucurito went on, he called me one day, he goes, Mark, I'm going to be the creative director of the Source magazine. I'm going to get you in next week to shoot some stuff. I'm like, oh, that's great, Dave. What's the Source? Oh, it's hip hop. What's hip hop? I mean, I knew Puff Daddy, you know what I mean? But I didn't really have any knowledge of what hip hop was, the roots, the culture, anything. So he calls me into this magazine. And I'm a little white guy from Glasgow, you know what I mean? I go into the office and it's all like real kind of hip hop people. Hello. And he says, okay, so I want you to go out to New Jersey. It's the year anniversary of Biggie Smalls' death. And I want you to photograph his mum, Mrs. Smalls. Brilliant. What kind of, just do what you do, Mark. Great. So I did a bit of research. I don't think I knew who Biggie was. I mean, not in a bad way, but it was not part of my thing. So I drive out to New Jersey in a rental car. I don't think I had an assistant with me, just me. And I opened the door and this charming, wonderful woman, I said, I'm here from the Source. And she goes, okay, we're expecting you, or I'm expecting you. And I did these great pictures. Made some pictures of Mrs. Wallace, and I'm leaving, and she goes, listen, there's some, if you want to hang about, there's some people coming over to for the anniversary of, you know, my son's death or whatever it is. Yeah, I can hang about for a minute, have a cup of tea, whatever. And then, like, all these people start arriving, And now it's very funny. It was like Puff, who I knew, but like Lil' Kim came, about three or four other like people I should have known but didn't start coming. And it just, it was like, oh, this is interesting. And I think I did okay because I had no, I think they couldn't pigeonhole me as somebody. So I'm just my Glasgow self, you know, I'm just myself. And oh, what do you do? Oh, I do rap. Oh, cool. What kind of rap? You know, like, so I think it was this, who the hell is this guy? But not in a bad way, you know, I was, because just as a human being, I'm genuinely interested in people. And, you know, I think that was kind of what was okay. And then I started working more and more and more for The Source. And it was great. It was a great experience. I mean, I got to, you know, all of a sudden, like, I get a call that, can you photograph DMX? Like, sure. I had done his album cover. No, I'd done something. I'd photographed him before for something. It was like first time, I think, for another magazine. And I was like, sure. And he goes, he's not going to show up unless it's you, Mark. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, like every time, it was just these bizarre kind of things that happened that still blow my mind to this day. And the other thing about working for The Source was I was there one day. I was in a, I think I was married. I had a brief starter marriage. And I was in my brief starter marriage and I'm working in the, I'm in visiting the creative director and there's a little knock on the door and this very beautiful young lady comes in a brown velour kind of track suit top thing. She was absolutely beautiful. And Dave says, hey, Mark, this is Katie. She's our new director of our editor for Source Sports. I was like, oh, nice to meet you. I'm Mark. And that is my wife today. Mm. So that took a long time, but we were friends. But yeah, The Source was magnificent. And then it kind of all went pear-shaped. Like it just, you know, did through The Source, then started coming a lot of hip-hop album packages. And then all of a sudden it was like, all I want to do is stand beside my car. I was like, well, Jay did it, like, you know. And it just started to get so, and I felt I needed to kind of segue a little bit out of music. I was finding it. I mean, listen, I've never turned down a job, but I was pushing towards other things. And I suppose that's when kind of the celebrity stuff started to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, part of what you said in there is that, you know, there's certain genres, certain cultures, certain things where it's like, everyone has, you know, there's one shot that becomes iconic and then everyone wants their version of the same shot, you know? So it's like every cover looks the same, every album looks the same, like all the stuff looks the same. And for them, you know, it's probably, well, I'm sort of like, you know, I'm sharing in this iconic moment, but for you as somebody who's behind the lens, it's sort of like at a certain point, it's sort of like, you know, your own creative Jones starts to want more, yearn for something that's out of that box.
Definitely, and 100%, and it's very rarely that I'll let my creativity get in front of the fact that I'm getting paid or making photographs, because that is to me the most important thing, and creativity does get stifled. But I'm incredibly fortunate in just the team player and being part of it and going and meeting people and talking to people, and the experiences are just as important to me as the final image. I know a lot of photographers, and I may be a little envious of them, that are just so committed to that final image. And I'm not committed like that. I'm committed to the experience and doing it. And, you know, and I think that allowed me to do stuff that I didn't necessarily want to do. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, it does.
I was working.
Right. So, I mean, for you, I guess for some people, it's all about the final product, right? It's about the shot. Yeah. But it sounds like for you, that's part of it, but that's only part of why you're like, part of it is about, it's about the interaction, the conversation, the moment.
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good Light Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. It's interesting. I was scanning back through some of the stuff that you posted on Instagram, and there was you shared a shot of George Carlin, and the caption was something like, "The shot is meaningful to you. Like when you reflect on it, you would have done it differently." Yeah. But what you love about the shot is it reminds you of the time you spent with him.
Hang out with George Carlin. You know, I like me and George having a chat. To me, that is so much more valuable than this image, which is not my favorite and, you know, not great, not anything. But that 20 minutes with George Carlin, man, just listening to him on a personal one-on-one is everything. And that is so much of the experience. And yeah, it happens a lot with celebrities, but it's real people as well. It's like, when do you get this chance to really, you know, and it's brief and it's fleeting. And for that, it can be authentic because, you know, you're probably never going to see that person again. And that to me is the experience. And what I'm beginning to understand, looking back in retrospect, is that the conversation and the authenticity of the conversation makes for the portrait. So they work very much in tandem. But if you said to me, "Okay, we're going to destroy that picture of George Carlin, and nobody will ever see it again, or we're going to take away your memory," I'd say take the photo 100 times.
Mm.
Because it's the experience. You know, even in retrospect, looking back at that picture, what I do like about it is the communication. That's kind of I don't like the light, focus is bad, the exposure was wrong, but the communication is what sits with me in that memory.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because I think what a lot of people think about a photographer, a particular photograph, let's say, you know, they think about, well, you know, this is a great depiction of the fact of what was seen. But what they probably don't think about is But this is actually, it's always got to be some blend of the fact of what appeared before the lens and the person who chose how they were going to capture it. But maybe there's a third thing in there also, which is the quality of, especially if you're talking about portraiture, the quality of the interaction at that moment in time, it's got to elicit something, you know? So it sounds like it's really this blend of these three different things.
Definitely. And I would say the third one is the most important. I have so many examples of just, you know, as anybody who's kind of talked to me about photography or portraiture knows, and, you know, somebody comes into, just as we kind of touched on, they come into a room, I come into a room, we're both there for a purpose. You're there to have your picture taken. I'm there to make the picture. It's hard to remember what I was thinking 25 years ago, but what I'm thinking now is my light. I kind of know what I'm doing, right? It was 30 years. If I don't know, the second nature. Exposure is second nature. Composition is not second nature, but it's coming easier to me now. So all I have to do, I've got a great team that helps, you know, with these things, and I'm still very aware of everything that's going on, but I know I don't have to think about it. The only thing I have to focus on, and I'm not that great at that either, is getting something going on between us, you know, getting you to smile or to nod or to tell you a story and shoot through that moment. That's all I focus on now. And it's really changed. I've really begun to like more of my photos for that, because I can really feel that, yeah, I made that happen. It's not saying anything about me, but it's saying something about that person. And I've provoked that or induced that or made that happen. And that I think is the essence of a good portrait. And I think I've made like three that I could really say, wow, if I had to only have three photographs, these would be the ones. And mostly it's not because of light, it's not because of composition, it's not because of any of the other factors. It's just that moment. The eyes are the authenticity of what's happening between sitter and photographer.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's all about.
When that happens, do you know it when it happens?
Yeah, I do a happy dance. I've really, I call it like the photo gods align, right? And the factors that make up for a portrait, which are all the things we've discussed, the light, composition, exposure, they can align quite easily for me. But when that fourth one, where the thing, the moment, the second, the millisecond or 1/25th of a second or whatever hits it at that point. And yeah, you know it, you see it in your camera. You see it and you go, oh, okay, I got it.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel it in your bones at the same time?
No, but, I mean, it's just like, okay. And what I tend to do when that happens is go, oh, there's there's a technical side of things, but there's a brilliant button. I'm sure lots of cameras have it, but the Leica SL2, which I've been shooting on a lot, it's a mirrorless, so it has a digital viewfinder. So you're not really seeing through the glass, which I don't like, but it has this one feature where if you press a button and the viewfinder comes up the last picture you took. So you can be staring at the last picture you took, but not with your hands down, so it doesn't appear like you're chimping. I think that's what they call it when you chimp down. So you're chick, check. So I can chimp from here. And if I see it and I feel it, then I'll just go, we got it. And people are like, what? You've only taken 20 frames. I'm like, well, we got it. We're not getting any better. And then sometimes I get a big smile and I'll take that picture. But
you're like, sweet, I'm out of here. And you're like, no, that's the shot.
But yeah, I'm still nervous and anxious going into any job. And I think the anxiety mixed with the nervous energy allows me to to bring out this personality. I don't know who this guy is when he comes out, but it's me. And it's good for about 7 minutes. So 7 minutes is a good amount of time for me. And then it just gets bored, or I get weird, or say something really bad or stupid. we should have stopped.
Right. I'm fascinated that, you know, you're 3 decades into your career. You've shot many of the highest profile people on the planet, and yet you still walk in anxious.
Petrified.
Do you ever wonder what that's about?
Yeah. There's so many factors that can go wrong. You know, I think I'm doing what I love, and I'm always trying to do something better, and I'm always very aware of that. And then I have these crazy pre-shoot anxiety dreams, usually the night before. I mean, everything from my camera melting, you know, like I turn around to my assistant, Alex, why is the camera melting? Oh, we've got another. Oh, Mark, the other camera's melting. You know, these really vivid anxiety dreams, you know, about photography. And I have to say, in the whatever years I've been taking photos, everything that can go wrong has gone wrong. So I've witnessed it firsthand, you know. I mean, I went on a shoot, I forgot sync cable and the light. You know, I went on another shoot with a certain hip hop artist, and he's hitting delete instead of the forward arrow. And that was in the time before delete didn't go to the trash. That was when delete was delete, early digital software. I've done a shoot and I've brought the film home, and by accident, I haven't hand-checked the 800 ISO film, and it's gone through the scanner. I've lost film somewhere between me and the darkroom. Had to scan the Polaroid and give that to them. I mean, anything that has gone, I mean, we haven't killed anybody, thankfully, or anything like that. But anything photographically, camera breaking, dropping the camera, ruining the film, deleting the file, any of these things have happened. So I think that is probably part of where the anxiety comes from. And then, you know, it's a weird balance, because the more prepared I try to be, the less prepared I am. I know the things that I've got to get right. Like, I've got to get the equipment there. I've got to get my functioning camera there. I've got to get the light for how I perceive the shot. But if I start thinking about really, truly about what I want to do, then I go into this kind of crazy whirlpool craziness. So being prepared is my equipment, but mentally I just try not to think about it too much till I get there, and then I get anxious.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting also because the way you shoot, so much of capturing the shot is about the moment that you create with the person. So it's almost like the more anxious you show up, the less capable you are of creating that, which probably makes you more anxious.
Exactly. it's spiral. Yeah. I've had anxiety dreams where I can't speak, where I'm trying to talk to the person, I just go, what? And I can't actually vocalize. I've had that dream. And I've actually witnessed that actually happen to somebody. I think that's probably where the dreams came from. When we're shooting Obama in the White House, I had a photo assistant with me that I'd been working for a long time, incredible young man. And he had been through everything, you know, we'd had it all, any disaster. The shoot went well for the 5 minutes we got to shoot. And then as Obama wanted to meet everyone, have his photo with everyone. And I said, and this is my assistant. And Obama took his hand and shook it and said, how's your summer going? And my photo assistant just kind of went and could not physically speak. And I've never seen that happen to another human being before. And Obama was so cool. He said, well, enjoy the rest of it, or something like that. It was just magnificent. So I think after I saw that, then obviously that became an anxiety dream. I turn into somebody. It's not Mark when I'm taking photos. It's somebody. I mean, it's not like, you know, grumpy Mark. I mean, my wife calls me the Grinch, especially this time of year. But that's not what you get when I go to take your picture. But it can't last. As I say, it's like 5 minutes, and then everyone's like, all right, get them off.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious also, is it, if you got your 5 to 7 minutes where you have like this window to create a certain amount of conversational magic to sort of like try and create something that grabs the shot, is the time limitation in part, you know, okay, so you're shooting celebrities, generally they don't have a lot of time, you got to be in and out fast, but also I'm curious about your ability to sustain that. It seems like you're very gregarious, you're very easy in conversation. But I wonder also, do you feel like you're more introverted or extroverted, and that being almost that forward-facing, being a part of the experience actually is hard for you to sustain just on a personal level? Or is that not part of it?
Every interaction I have, I can turn into practice for taking a photograph. So if I go into the deli to buy a can of Coke, if my head's in a certain place, which it is often, I go, all right, I'm going to photograph this guy. What am I going to say to him as I hand over the money? I want to make this guy laugh. I want to shock this guy. And mentally, it's constantly thinking about, how am I going to make this guy laugh? How am I going to make this woman laugh? How am I going to? It's much to the chagrin of my wife and family who get to witness this, but it's great practice for me. So I think it's practice. It's definitely practice. It's definitely practice of communication. But I have genuinely found that interacting with every human being you meet, and I can't do it all the time, but if you interact as if you're going to take their picture, then you both have a better interaction.
Mm. Do you always have a camera with you when you're walking around, or is it more like phone? Or
My phone. So bad. And I keep buying these bloody cameras to have a camera with me, and I'm so bad. It's a major irk for me, and I've tried so hard. There's a fellow who works for Leica, who's a really good friend of mine. He's a pro services guy. His name is John Kreidler. And I've never done street photography ever. I live in New York City. I don't see anything. It's pathetic. You know, I go for a walk, I don't see anything. Anybody who was a reasonable street photographer walking around New York for a day would get great photos. I don't see it. I don't understand it. I don't know if I should step beyond me. I said, hey, John. John's a really good street photographer. I said, John, can you give me a lesson in street photography? He goes, yeah, sure, come on. So we go out, and my office is in Chinatown. So we were walking around the kind of core area there, which is pretty low-hanging fruit because it's pretty magnificent. Right? So he wanted to, you know, so it's a, you know, one of these New York light shadow days, really strong sunlight, really harsh shadows. And I'm walking along, and I'm framing up a shot of the pillars from the side of the court building. And I'm just framing it up, and I'm just like, oh, well. So work with the light and shadows, make a composition. All right, I think I got something. Yeah, this is pretty good. And at that moment, this woman in a full-length red coat decided to walk out between two of the pillars in the right place. And miraculously, I pressed the photo. I pressed the button at that moment and got her kind of in the air, like leaping off a step. And I looked at it, and I think, I am now retiring from street photography. I am done. I will never, ever match that again, ever. So I've retired as a street photographer. I'm still waiting for that moment in portraits.
So you had your one magnificent day.
Yeah, I'm retired. Never do that again.
You know, it's interesting. I have this curiosity because I think we're all walking around with cameras in our pockets now. Whether you have, you know, a Lycra and a strap around your neck, or whether you have a phone in your pocket. My curiosity is, on the one hand, I feel like if I'm going out, if I'm always sort of like in this mode where I'm in scan and capture mode, you know, I'll probably see a lot more in my life. Even if I never take a shot, if I'm in that mode, I will be seeing, I'll be actively moving through my day seeing. But then I also wonder if the dark side to that is I won't be as in it myself, because I'm in a mode of looking to capture, looking to witness and frame and capture rather than being in the frame. and being in it. And I wonder if there's that tension, that because I sometimes feel that when I'm walking around and I'm almost in that, you know, like I want to capture some cool stuff mode. I'm like, but what if I'm just here? Like, what if I'm actually in the frame and me wanting to capture the frame stops me from living it?
Wow, that's very, very interesting insight. I absolutely hear what you're saying, but I don't suffer from it because I'm never looking. But that's a hard scenario. I think with everything, it's if you're capable, I would say there's capture days and there's not capture days. And but that's really, really difficult. You know, I went to see Jerry Seinfeld a few months ago. A few months ago before the pandemic, and he does this bit about, you know, he's walking through town or whatever. He's got his buddy, and his buddy goes, Jerry, look at that. And he just doesn't want to look. He doesn't want to fill his head with whatever. He says, oh, it's a guy over there doing this crazy thing. And Jerry's like, okay, I got the picture. He keeps walking. And I think I'm a bit like that. I don't want to see it because I don't want to feel guilty about not taking a photograph. So if I don't see it, then, you know, I think your point is very, very interesting. And because when I'm working mostly, it's very intense, short periods of time. I mean, there's a lot of hurry up and wait, but to go looking for something out with that, I don't have the discipline. I don't have the talent or the discipline. And I don't like it enough. I don't particularly like being cold. I don't particularly like being alone. And I think most of the street photographers, somebody came to my office the other day to pick up a lens that I had borrowed from Leica that he was borrowing. And it was pissing fucking down in New York City. It was like one of these torrential downpour days. And he's a very well-known street photographer. And he's got his full anorak on and his hood up. And I have to take the lens out as to it. So we run under a bus stop. And so how's your day going? Like, really sarcastically, like, you know. And he goes, oh, it's brilliant. I'm getting great stuff. I'm like, wow. Mind blowing. So yeah, I'm not that guy. I am certainly not that guy, but major respect to those who are. I think you should, for you, I think you shouldn't be hard on yourself and not overthink it.
You know, it's interesting. I think I've also inadvertently found myself doing what you said, where it's sort of like, you know, there are times where I'm just out, you know, where I am right now, I can, you know, in 5 minutes, I'm walking on a dirt trail in the middle of stunning mountains, and
right. And
I have this impulse, you know, because I look out and I'm scanning the horizon, and I'm like, this is the most stunning moment, you know, I can't believe what I'm seeing, and then my next impulse is to reach into my pocket, and I have to capture this because
it looks like crap.
Right. And then, yeah, it never actually reflects anything. But then I'm also like, I'll literally put my hand on my phone and then I'll stop myself. And I'm like, no, man, like, that's not the point of this moment.
Right.
You know, there's a time and a place for that. Yeah. You know? And so I think I have a similar wiring to you.
If you can do that for real, I do it through laziness. But if you can actually do it for real, I think you're really onto something.
Yeah, I go back and forth. You know, some days I do it. Some days I'm just like, okay, so this will be my time to capture. But then other days I'm like, no, this is just my time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also, I think it comes from the experience. We're out walking. There's a golf course just behind us here in Long Island. And we were out walking on the golf course, and the light was that kind of William Merritt Chase stunning. I mean, the light was just unbelievably beautiful. And there was a three-quarter moon. It was still about 4 p.m. It was a three-quarter moon, and the sun was going down behind, and the layers and the levels and the moon. And it was just, and, you know, somebody I was with said, oh, you should take a photo. This is gorgeous. And I just knew that the moon would look tiny, the colors would be wrong, the scale would be wrong. I was like, yeah, if I had X, Y, Z, D to do this. And so, yeah, I pull out my camera, I take a snapshot, I come back, yeah, let's see that photo. I'm like, it didn't look like that. I'm like, yeah. So I think also the experience of knowing that that it's better to live it as a moment and keep the memory, as you were saying, and or why you're there, you know. I mean, I have a 6-year-old, and I've been pretty reasonable at documenting him, mostly through cell phone. But, you know, once every 6 months, I'll photograph him with a camera. And I don't think I've made very many successful pictures, but I've been pretty successful about documenting his different stages. So that was insightful.
Yeah.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So I got to ask you about something, because you shared throughout the conversation a number of times a sense of, I would almost say, profound humility about the level of skill in creating images. And from the outside looking in, I think, you know, I look at the images that you have created over a long window of time, so many just stunning portraits where I will literally sit there, you know, and just look. And I don't know why I'm looking, but I know there's something immensely powerful about it. And I know I'm not the only one. You know, there's something stunning. There's something deeply moving about this. And here you are 30 years into your career, sort of like struggling to stand in that place of like, I do have this certain, there's something about a place where I am right now that allows me to create some really powerful images that move people.
I'm definitely incredibly grateful. And I think there's so many expressions, fake it till you make it or whatever. You're only as good as your last photograph, even though I haven't heard that one for a while. But it's hard when you're a freelancer. I think you spend so much of your time worrying about, you know, how you're going to pay for this and pay for that. And, you know, the struggles are very real for photographers. I mean, I'm thankfully in a better position than, you know, I used to be, but so many times you do a shoot, the client's happy, and you put it behind you and you're looking forward. You're never looking back at that. You know, that was pretty good. Like, what's next? What's next? How am I going to make this? Some of it now, thankfully, has developed into, I don't have to worry about money so much, but it hasn't taken away the worry of what's next. What am I going to do next? How am I going to do better? But I think in the last 2 or 3 years, doing things like this has forced me to be a little more retrospective about everything. And sometimes I kind of take a quick glance at the catalog and go, Jesus, that's a lot of work. Some of it's not bad. But I don't think I'm ever going to be the person that, I think when you think you're doing great and when you think everything's great, it's time to hang it up. I still have the passion to do better. I'll always have the passion to do better. You know, if I look at some of my absolute heroes, Payne, Avedon, you know, there's 10 photos. They made thousands of fabulous photos, but there's 10, right? That are, I'm maybe one, two, I don't know. So if these guys were always striving to be better and to move forward and to work with the times and the different way things are happening, then I think it's a bit of a joke to think that, you know, me as a photographer can't do better and be better. And I think that's the genuine humility of where it comes from. And I also think that if you can find a balance on set between being kind of cool and not a dick, I mean, often people who I'm photographing have seen my work and have often an idea of who I am and what I've done. But if you can play the humility card and it's genuine and give off the impression that you know exactly what you're doing, but you fumble around a little bit, I think it's endearing.
It actually helps with the work at the end of the day. But you also, I mean, not to skip over that one thing that you said, and it's genuine, you know, and with you, you know, you really feel it is. And there's this sense of, yes, I'm 30 years into my career, but I have this perpetual beginner's mind.
Total.
It's such an important part of who you are.
You just keep saying the things that I want to say much smarter than I say them. No, you're right. I've never thought about it like that. But yeah, I have a beginner's mind. You've nailed it. I mean, that's exactly what it is. How do I make this better? What I did do during the pandemic was really interesting for me. Was I've been promising myself to do a book. And it kind of started as 20 years in New York, and now it's 25 years in New York, and a couple of days it'll be 26 years. But, people I talked to and people I respect said, you got to find an angle. You're not going to be happy about just a book of your photos because it's just not who you are. So I really trying to find an angle. And what I kind of came up with was to go back over all the old shoots and look at stuff that I'd missed or stuff that I didn't consider because the client hadn't considered it and it just went away, or more importantly, stuff that appeals to me now but didn't appeal to me then. You know, sometimes if you were doing something for someone, there's some shots back there that have the great interaction that weren't lit perfectly that I looked over because the client was looking for this or that. So I retouched around 250 pictures during the pandemic. I went back to the beginning of my digital catalog because my film wasn't with me. It's in storage. And I'm nearly through that. And the next stage is to go back to the film and do the same stuff. And although I'm not, you know, if somebody looking at it, it might not see it. It's not like a glaring statement. I still think there's still photographs of merit that I've taken, but there's just a slight difference going back and looking at pictures from 25 years ago.
Beyond trying to curate something potentially for a book, just what was that experience like for you going back and like looking through?
Horror. Can't believe I did that. Can't believe I didn't do this. Oh, actually, that would work, but it's I didn't mean to do that. No, it was incredibly anxiety provoking, and it was a wonderful pandemic project because it kept me truly focused, and there was no client pressure because I was a client, I am the client, so there's no client pressure, so I, you know, could work at weird times, you know, wake up at 5 before, you know, the family got up, do a few hours, and then like work late into the night because I could go for a sleep in the afternoon because, you know, I wasn't actually shooting so much. So it was the pandemic flew past, or the first, I mean, now it's Dragon, because I'm kind of back at work and shooting, and that's another crazy. I mean, thank God I'm shooting, but it's added a whole new level. But the pandemic kind of flew past. The summer months flew past. And in retrospect, if I have to find a silver lining, I think that's a major. I would never, ever, ever have done this if it wasn't for the fact that I was, you know, in isolation for 6 months. So yeah, it was horrific. But I did learn. I learned things not to do more than things to do.
Yeah, I mean, beyond the technical experience, were you able to savor any of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, there was one shoot that I went back to. It was pretty recent shoot, and I'd photographed Chris Rock. And I'd forgotten I'd photographed Chris Rock. I mean, not in a bad way. I mean, just like, if somebody had said, Mark, have you photographed Chris Rock? I'd go, yeah. But it just in my head, it wasn't there. I thought, oh, Chris Rock. Oh, yeah. So, like, for instance, that. And I was like, wow, there's a good photo in here. So, yeah, there was definitely some very pleasant surprises that were usually quickly undone by dreadful, horrific errors. No, but it was nice to revisit the story. Looking through the pictures reminds me of the story, and there's always a story. So there's always a new, a different studio, or, do you remember the lunch we had after that, or do you remember the fact that we forgot film and we had to? So there's always a story. So it was nice to relive the stories.
I love that. I'm a big believer in that, a good life is a well-storied life. And if you have this catalog of images that for you, even though nobody else will know this, it for you, it triggers a moment, a conversation, a story, it's pretty cool.
I was looking back at a shoot that I did for Men's Health. It was a cover for Men's Health of Usher. And we were staying in LA, and we were shooting on a beach, one of the beach houses in Malibu that was for rent. It was back in the early 2000s, probably, where, there was budget, there was a DJ on set, there was a kind of budget for stuff and styling and motorhome and a big cover for a national magazine. And we've checked and double checked and triple checked the equipment. We know we've got everything, because we know when we get to Malibu, we're kind of done. And film has been delivered, it's in a bag, it's there, everything's there. We get out to Malibu and set up our lights, and everything's looking great. And I said to whoever was helping me that day, or who the team, I said, give me some Polaroid, I'm going to rattle off some Polaroid and just make sure the light's okay. And they come back and they're both ashen faced, we don't have any Polaroid, but we ordered it. Yeah, it's not in the bag with the film. We've got no Polaroid. Now, I wouldn't actually be that worried about that, but I know the creative director, the art director, and 60 other people are going to see Polaroids. So Usher comes out, and he's changed. He's ready to go. He'd go on set. And I think anybody who knew me could see that I'm certainly anxiety, although I wasn't showing it. And I turned around to my friend, to the stylist, who was a friend or somebody I knew quite well. I said, do me a favor, I've got no Polaroid. It's on its way from LA. It's going to be like another 40 minutes. I don't like, can you change the pants? But take your time with it. And she's like, so he goes in and they're like, well, did you take a Polaroid? I said, no, I didn't like the pants. So one of my assistants realized that Russian Vogue was in the house next door. And I said, just go ask them for a pack of Polaroid. Tell them we'll give them it back in 5 minutes. So she goes over and, it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And Usher is like coming back out. She comes back. She's got a pack of Polaroid. Rip open the Polaroid. And, back in the day, you'd take like 20, 30 Polaroids. I was like taking three and really examining them, showing them around. And the creative director who's worked with me for a while is like, what the fuck is wrong with him? What are you doing? And then, so I said, I think we'll do the shot. We'll do the shot because I've got film. So we start doing the shot, and I can see from the beach the road, and I see the delivery van coming, and I kind of relax and do the shoot. But that, you know, that story is just going to stay with me forever. I remember telling Usher about it another time I photographed him. He goes, no, I didn't realize there was anything wrong. But me as a human being probably took 10 years off my life, but still kept the pretense that everything was okay.
Yeah, I mean, you look, all these images are just, they're all these backstories that nobody could look at the image and know what the story is associated with it. But but for you, there's so much more there.
Well, that was going to be the name of the book, Crap Story, Crap Photos, Good Stories. Don't look at the photos, but the stories are good. The other thing that came about during the pandemic was this I teach a few Leica Academy seminars every year, and I have absolutely no gift for teaching, but I do quite enjoy the process of giving information that people want. And I get a ton of requests on Instagram and my social, how do you do this? How do you make this? And some of them are like, well, you put a lens on it. But a lot of them are much deeper than I ever thought they would be. And people take a long time. And I got a bit of a reputation for answering people, which is really nice. I try and answer everybody. So we started a YouTube channel. It's called Complicated Things. And we're not going to teach you how to set your f-stop, but we maybe hopefully teach you how to budget for a job. You know, that's been really, really nice to do. So if you get a moment, folks, check out Complicated Things. There's going to be some giveaways. Complicated Things.
That's awesome. I haven't actually seen that, so I'm going to have
to check it out. It's kind of fun. It's me and my partner, Alex, and we have different views on things, which is great. I'm kind of old school, and he's like young and knows what he's doing and is able to multitask. And, you know, if you hand me more than one thing, I'm...
It feels like a good place for us to come full circle as well. So hanging out here in this container of Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
Ooh, to live a good life. It changes every day, doesn't it? I mean, it changes in your circumstances. I think to truly live a good life, and I certainly wish I took more of my own advice here, would be to take every day, look around you, see what you can do, see what you can experience, see what you can contribute, and not delay things, because if you delay, then you don't do it. So I think living a good life is making the most of every day, depending on the circumstances. I mean, sometimes, you know, I photographed Michael Douglas, and he was just after his cancer surgery, and he said, I've got a bit of advice for you. He said, it's something very similar to what you're saying. He says, when you're sick, you got to make the most of it, because there's nothing else you can do. So even if you're not feeling great or not, you know, you're not feeling well, make the most of that. I would like to take more of my own advice there. Sometimes I just, I don't want to do this, and then regret it. And sometimes the rewards for the effort aren't immediate, and sometimes the rewards don't come back for months or years, or, you know, the time that I insist on spending with my son right now. I'm chopped liver, basically. If mum's around, forget it. But I really believe that putting in this energy and the time is, and I see little hints of this payback, you know, just like, hey, daddy, do you want to, I'm like, okay. Yeah. It's a great question.
That's the stuff that matters. Well, thank you. I really appreciate the conversation.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's SparkeType.com. mindfulbirth.com or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.